One.
Is that long enough, hard enough for them to hear?
Yeah, I think so. They hear.
They hear, okay.
They hear.
Go ahead.
Why don't you start?
You start, Janet.
Okay. I'll give the title. I thought of one.
You did? Do I need to give you background?
Just your name and... Well, I can just really try to be... We're going to stop this now.
My name is Janet Grant. I live here at the Village. I've been living here for a couple years as registrar and have a particular interest in the area of homosexuality and sexuality, and mentioned that to James Frank the other day, and that's why I'm here today.
And I'm Magali Rodriguez Mossman, and I'm here to sing a song.
Yay.
And I'm James Frank Mossman, and I'm still wondering why I'm here.
The name of this session
is Sexual Identities and Perspectives, A Christian's Reflections.
Oh, they'll love that on the tape, on the label. We're going to start off with a song that some of you may have heard because it came out in the 60s. And if you know it, you know, you'll probably remember the chorus most of all. Please sing along, okay? I hope you have your humor hats on.
Well, I'm just a typical American boy from a typical American town. I believe in God and Senator Dodd and keeping old Castro down. And when it came my time to serve, I knew better dead than red. But when I got to my old draft board, buddy, this is what I said. Sarge, I'm only 18, I've got a ruptured spleen, and I always carry a purse. Got eyes like a bat, and my feet are flat, and my asthma's getting worse. Now consider my career, my sweetheart dear, my poor old invalid aunt. Besides, I ain't no fool, I'm a-going to school and a-working in a defense plant. Got a dislocated disc and a racked up back. I'm allergic to flowers and bugs. And when a bombshell hits, I get epileptic fits, and I'm all addicted to 1,000 drugs. Got the weakness woes, can't touch my toes, I can hardly reach my knees. And when the enemy gets too close to me, well, I just start to sneeze. Sarge, I'm only 18, I've got a ruptured spleen, and I always carry a purse. Got eyes like a bat, and my feet are flat, and my asthma's getting worse. Now consider my career, my sweetheart dear, my poor old invalid aunt. Besides, I ain't no fool, I'm a-going to school and working in a defense plant. Ooh, I hate Joe and Lie, and I hope he dies, but one thing you've gotta see, that someone's gotta go over there, that someone isn't me. Now I wish you well, Sergeant, give 'em hell, kill me 1,000 or so. And when you ever have a war without blood and gore, well, I'll be the first to go. Sergeant, I'm only 18, I've got a ruptured spleen, and I always carry a purse. Got eyes like a bat, and my feet are flat, and my asthma's getting worse. Now consider my career, my sweetheart dear, my poor old invalid aunt. And ain't no fool, I'm a-going to school and working in a defense plant.
And I hope that's not what we're gonna do.
Well, we want to focus the discussion on today is the two main areas. One is the area of considering sexual alternatives or alternative sexual identities such as homosexuality, and that whole question that's very alive and unfortunately well in the church today. And the other is how that relates to the whole history we have of the lack of taking seriously incarnation or the whole thing of disembodiment within the church. And I don't know where we're going to get with all of that, but we're going to try, and we're going to depend a lot on the discussion, I believe, and comments. We do have some things we want to share, but we'll see where we go. I'd like to just start by saying, kind of rubber banding back to what we were saying a few days ago on the sexual development Norwegian style section of, as you recall, those of you that were here, that one of the things that's coming out in the research of the Norwegian Sexual Institute is that all of us, men and women, start off from a point of similarity as far as our sexuality goes. That even in utero, as far as they can do with sonograms and so on, they find that male children experience an erection about every 90 minutes, and the conjecture is that female children will lubricate at about the same rate. They do know that from the ages of one or two that same pattern continues. They also have found through this research that all of us of both sexes are indiscriminate at that point. And whether or not we turn ourselves on by being with a male child or a female child, that a boy child will get turned on equally at the age of 1, 2, 3, 4 by another boy taking a bath with them, playing with them, and so on. They'll experience erections and so on, and female children will lubricate. That there's, at around the age of 7, there gets to be this shift that says it's not okay for me to be turned on sexually by someone of the same sex. And that most children, while we pick up the negative messages, if it's a male, you pick up the aggressive messages and the kind of caretaker messages and a lot of those things. But most children will make that transition fairly comfortably and fairly well, especially if they aren't discounted as far as their sexuality. There are some, though, and this is why it becomes a major question, that don't make that transition, but what they learn instead is to go into the closet regarding their sexual orientation. I just wanted to link us back to that, because I think it's important for us to realize a couple of just facts. However we consider this from a moral and ethical and biblical point of view, I think it's important to realize that we are created beings, and we start out with a lot more similarities than we do with differences, and that there's a way in which we can be attracted to each other as much as distracted by each other. One other thing, just to get us started on some kind of base for our considerations in our discussion, that I'd like to focus on is probably the best, or at least the longest, piece of social research that has been done now and has been replicated in almost every major center around the country, a major university medical center around the country. And it was the research initially started by Kinsey, through the University of Indiana, where in his initial research for his book, The Sexual Response in Males, interviewed something in the neighborhood of 1,000 different people and came up with two scales called the 0 to 6 scales. And the first scale he measured, his interview questions had to do with orientation. They had to do with more or less subconscious or unconscious material coming out of dreams and out of fantasy life and out of thoughts that just kind of come in and feelings that come in. When he did that, regarding people's orientation, he found that about 10% of the population reported that they had never, ever had a same-sex dream or fantasy. That always they'd been opposite sex oriented. And by that, he meant things like had never had a dream where somebody showed up in the dream that had the sexual organs of both sexes. or had never had a dream where there was someone of the same sex involved in any way. Didn't necessarily mean that there was sexual activity between the people that showed up in the dreams or fantasies, but it might be like people of both sexes involved in a kind of group thing that would show up in a dream or fantasy and so on. About 10% reported they'd never had anybody of the same sex anywhere in their dream life or in their fantasy life. And about 10% reported that they'd never had anybody of the opposite sex in their dream life or in their fantasy life. And that the rest of us fell very much under a normal bell curve. In other words, a person that was bisexual on a 3 would report almost equal at that level. Many people would report, like my own experience with my own dream and fantasy life, somewhere I'd put myself at about a 1.5, somewhere in there. That there'll be occasionally people of the same sex that'll show up in a dream or something like this. You might just check out with yourself sometime, you know, who shows up in your dreams and who shows up in your fantasies, and see where you might put yourself on this scale. Then he did a second scale. And incidentally, now the number of interviewees on these scales runs around up in the millions, because it's, like I say, it's been replicated and the same thing is held up. He did a second scale on sexual behaviors. What people have been, which is much more conscious because it's what we have been taught is appropriate and acceptable in our culture. And of course, what shows up is a high predominance of opposite sex behavior. In other words, that most of us may have something going on in a fantasy life, or many of us at least, perhaps most of us is right. But behaviorally, we will have made a choice to act over here, especially if we fall somewhere in this end. That choice seems to be more or less possible, and sometimes even for people way over here, they will find themselves in marriages, even though, and we'll get into this more in a few minutes, but even though they know themselves to be homosexual or gay. Okay, the interesting thing on this, I think, is that if a person within a value system, a culture, a church, is experiencing something going on in their own inner life at about here, let's say, and their behavior or what they feel their behavior ought to be is over here, this gap is the fear gap. What if somebody should really know what was going on inside of me? What if it should ever come out that I'm occasionally having these thoughts? Or especially it would become more intense as one would find themselves over further on that side. The higher that fear is, of course, the greater the chances are that if one is living over here, at least historically, the greater the chances are that it's easy to put down. You know, Shakespeare's thing, I think he protests too much. In other words, it's very easy to find ways and so on of punishing someone who has come out of the closet as being gay would be one typical kind of experience of that sort of fear. Another way would be to become I don't want to offend anybody, but a Jerry Falwell kind of thing, you know, a real campaign against something in whatever way. There are many ways. Another way is, of course, to get depressed. And this is what I see a lot among people who are homosexual that I see in counseling, is a lot of depression where they're struggling with this. They may have even come out of the closet in part with certain people, maybe not with their families, and they're feeling just extreme depression around that.
What you're saying that those who would have a great tendency to be homosexuals then would come out against that?
Mm-hmm. Could very well come out against it, right. Yeah. In one way or another. It might be a campaign against it. It might be some of the kind of abusiveness and brutality that you can hear about and read about in many places. Some of that gets really, might be more subtle. It might be the kind of laws and ordinances a city has that doesn't give any sense of reconciliation. It might happen in a church where if the pastor, and we'll talk a bit about this, the pastor has not come out of the closet but is experiencing some sense of his orientation as being over here, could feel that if they ever knew, I would be rejected, even though he may have experienced a lot of love and care. But anyway, I just wanted to put that up for you to consider and to think about in terms of where some of the energy may be coming from, in terms of the, for one thing, in terms of the tremendous struggle the church seems to be going in right now with the whole thing of what do we do with people who have a sexual orientation that is other than a perfectly straight double zero orientation. The other thing is, now that doesn't speak at all to any of the moral or ethical questions around this. I think there's a real reason to speak to those too, and we need to do more and more with our scriptures and Bibles and see what really is said. But I do think it's important to have this. And also for anybody, one of the interesting things, what are we, a village of 400?
450.
450? 400. That means somewhere in here, very likely there's about 45 that are struggling with this question. You know, and I have yet, during 2 weeks at least, to have someone come up and say to me, this is what I'm struggling with. I think it just, but you can almost bet that in any place you go, there's about 10% of the people that are struggling very deeply with some of those issues for themselves around sexual orientation. Jen, do you want to read this?
This paper that I'm going to read to you for a few minutes now, it's 3 or 4 pages long. I'd like you to relax. Comfortable, and close your eyes, whatever makes you comfortable, and listen to it to me as I read. It came to me anonymously, and it remains anonymous. It's one person's story. So, I'm one of the gay pastors of the church. I don't know how many of us there are, but the number must be legion. I have known for a long time about my homosexuality. I was probably born with it. I know that it did not strike me suddenly like the measles. The knowledge began in high school, where I found conformity to be the accepted social patterns of dating and going steady to be utterly boring and meaningless. There was, however, nothing startling about the discovery that I was somehow different from the other boys of my age. I have always been rather shy, a trait that provided a natural explanation for the fact that I did not exactly fit the same pattern of emerging sexual awareness as that of my classmates. In college, I became more certain of my homosexuality. I began to find that there were others who wanted to share our common gayness. Because of the strong condemnation of homosexuality in both religious and social circles, even stronger than today's far more enlightened judgment, I did what most gays do. I hid my homosexuality in the closet, and I played the straight role. Fear was the overriding emotion that controlled my life. Exposure was the kiss of death. Almost no one survived the wrath of the righteous. Honorable careers and professions were reserved for the untainted and deserving. I felt God's call to the ministry of the church, but in order to answer that call in conformity with religious and social standards of acceptability, I had to continue my straight role and to guard it jealously. One slip would have been fatal. Since an unmarried minister was almost always the object of suspicion, I determined to marry, largely out of fear. I love my wife and children more than I love my own life. and they have given me their love in return in such measure as to be a constant source of wonderment and thankfulness. But I have never tried to deceive myself into believing that my part in our marriage was straight. The one thing that has caused me regret has been the fact that I could never be the complete husband and lover that my wife had every right to expect me to be. I have served in the ministry of the church for quite a few years, and I'm comfortable with who and what I am. I feel no guilt or shame, and I am convinced that I've been faithful to my Lord. If I should be accused of deceiving the members of my parish, my reply is that that deceit was not of my own making. I was forced into it. Although many friends condemn what I am without knowing that they are thereby condemning me, I believe that I am a child of God just as they believe that they are. I believe that the members of my parish love and respect me, and that most of them would support and defend me were my gayness to become generally known. It is the few who would not accept or forgive me who cause me great pain. Try as I may, I cannot comprehend the kind of understanding of the gospel that would in a split second change love and respect into condemnation and rejection simply because of a difference in sexual orientation. I do not claim that homosexuality is normal, that it is just one of several acceptable lifestyles. It is not what God intended for creation. But then, neither is adultery or promiscuity or the lust in the human heart which our Lord condemned. I agree with the position of Tilaki that to call homosexuality abnormal is not to make a moral or value judgment. The fact is, however, that one word can, in the eyes of friends and strangers alike, immediately turn me from a respectable person into something intrinsically evil, a thing of disgust, a social pariah, and a religious leper, and it brings bitter tears and despair. And my gay friends tell me that time brings little healing. I'm happy to say that my gay friends, my family, and those straight friends who accept me for what I am give me the support that sustains me most of the time. There are, however, times of desolation and loneliness that are overwhelming. At those times, my faith in my Lord, who does not condemn me but reaches down to draw me to God, is the only thing that helps me keep my sanity. The hardest thing for me, something that I am unable to reconcile or understand, is the attitude of the church towards me and my gay brothers and sisters. The church is my mother, and I love her with all my heart. But I find that I am a source of embarrassment to her, and that when I need most of her, for her to take me to her bosom and comfort and console me, she virtually abandons me. I must truly be monstrous in her sight. It offers me little satisfaction or comfort that those who condemn me and all gay people will themselves be judged someday. I know that ignorance and fear are the enemies of tolerance and loving, but I get little comfort from that fact. Those gays who are devastated by feelings of shame and guilt that have been piled on them by vindictive perverters of the gospel will in the end be their judges. But why is it that the church, while professing to preach the gospel, chooses to live by the law? Will the same church that refuses to ordain gays into its ministry judge me and take me from the ministry to which I devoutly believe I have been called if it becomes known that I am gay? By concealing the fact of my homosexuality for these past years, I have been guilty of some mortal sin that allows me no hope of salvation. Can I find no consolation in Jesus' words to the woman taken in adultery? Neither do I condemn you. I realize that what I have shared with you may appear to be almost devoid of hope. Sometimes that's the way it is. I have shed many tears in the past months, but I would not want you to think that everything is unrelievably black and hopeless. I love my work as a pastor, and I love my people dearly. I am eternally grateful for the way my family and friends have rallied around me and sustained me. I continue to seek the love and support which I receive from my gay brothers and sisters. There is a bond there which no straight person can ever fully understand. I have emerged only slightly from the closet because of the fear of judgment and rejection that is ever present. It is a dark cloud that never goes away. One thing is certain. I can never go back to the completely straight role. To do so would be a denial of myself. Worse than that, it would be a judgment on and rejection of my gay brothers and sisters, the very ones who have accepted me as one of their own, without reservation, and in whose company I increasingly find myself comfortable and at home. As for those of the straight community who will not accept me for what I am sorry, but I have at present no feelings of kindness or forgiveness. I pray that God will take from me the bitterness and resentment that I harbor for the sins committed against those of us who are gay. And lastly, I pray that the church may see the injustice which it perpetuates in the name of Christ. This is where the hurt is the greatest. May God forgive us both, gays and straights, and bring about a reconciliation that gives honor to God's holy name.
I'm not aware of what the statistic is, but there's probably, how many pastors are there in the Lutheran church bodies?
15,000.
That'd be 1,500 that would be struggling with that similar issue. It'd be a sizable community. And yet, how many of us know openly of different ones that are struggling with it? Yeah. It's frightening to think that we have that many people that are having to walk their path alone, apart from the body of Christ. At least it is to me. And there must be some other way of looking at this whole issue in light of the gospel and the body of Christ and incarnation than what we've done. Magali, before you leave, I'd like, if you'd be willing to share what you found in working with the inclusive church model and the, just give a little background on the gay community around that.
I'm wondering if you're talking about the webbed advocacy.
Webbed advocacy.
Part of what I'm doing in the church right now is going to all the different advocacy groups for the excluded, the poor, the disabled, the elderly, the young, the people of color, all the different people of color groups, Indians, blacks, Hispanics, etc. And I'm going to them and saying, immigrants, etc. When you come in to ask the church for something, ask not only for yourself, but ask for all these other groups too. You know, ask for something that's good for everybody so that you're not just advocating for yourself, and we'll have some type, what would I call it, an inclusiveness platform. If the women come in, they will also ask for everybody else. If the disabled go in, they ask for everybody else, and so on. And they all like to fight with me. But the one group that is extremely difficult, even gets people to hear that they might also ask for them, is the homosexuals, are the gay people in the church or in the community. It's after the first initial fight, that we can't use our energy to do something for someone else, we've got to keep it for ourselves. After that one is finished and they realize the beauty of coming in all together, the one group that they don't want to let in is the homosexual. And apparently it threatens our very, very identity of who we are. You know, the part of what I'm getting in the room right now is just a tremendous constriction in my throat, which is the values area. This is a values conflict that we have, you know, that we deal with right here. And so it's a...
Magali, what is the response of the gay lesbian community?
Oh, they're... Well, at first they didn't understand what I was saying, and they had the same reaction about initially, and then they said, you know, that's really true. And right now there's a group in Minneapolis that's called Wingspan, and there's a group of very conservative pastors that have asked for, I don't know, 1,000 copies of their brochure. It's the same group that went after that LSS program for young sex offenders. Okay. And so they were getting very concerned, and they asked me to come work with them for a little while. And so I was suggesting to them that what they do is they just melt into the congregation. You know, go back to their biblical roots, go back to the scriptures, go back to into doing the Bible studies, and just simply melt into the congregation, and let's see what they do to the congregation, you know, and stop making it a separate entity. Just simply put their energies to work for the whole group, and then it began to make sense to them, because then they realized that everybody then would be with them, you know, they would, by supporting first somebody else, those others then would return that love. And it's, and maybe we've all got to do that.
It's very true. I have a story that I want to tell you. So some of you may know or may not know that I'm an actor. And I had occasion one time to play a homosexual on the stage. And that homosexual had a love scene with another, only in words and touching, but certainly a very emotional scene with another character in the play who was a man as well. And I was having trouble finding the feeling that I needed to relate in that scene. And I had a very good friend of mine who was an actor, excellent actor, who was gay, and who I had just completed a play with. And he had a love scene. It was Richard II, and he had played Richard II. And there's a very poignant scene in that play, the king relating to his queen when they're being separated, and there is that he may well die, and they have a leave taking. And it was one of the most powerful scenes in the play. And I ran into Gary one evening, and we started talking about it, and I said, I'm really having a problem with creating a feeling within myself, dealing with this other man. And he said, you know, and I asked him, I said, how did you do so well? And he said, I cared about the other person as a human being, and it made it all the easier for me. In fact, it made it very easy, because we cared about each other. And in using that, I took that to the character that I portrayed, and I must tell you that we're just beautiful. Mm. It was just the greatest feeling. That night I went in the rehearsal, and the director came up afterwards and said, you've got it. And it worked through the whole thing. But because we care for other people, we care about them as human beings, we do not care about their sexual roles. We care about them because we are they.
They're not outside of us if we believe the hologram. They're only other aspects of us.
Say more about that.
Well, in the body of Christ, in this connectedness that we are, we cannot, if we reject the homosexual, we reject a piece of ourselves, we reject a part of creation. God obviously made homosexuals. And this is very obvious. And to me, when God makes such diversity of people in different colors, for example, it means that God must like people that are different colored. He must like the rainbow. She, he, they, snowflakes, whatever. And if God made a diversity of sexual orientation, then God must like a diversity of this sort. Now, I don't know, I'm not a moral theologian. I don't understand those things real well. All I know is that if I'm compassionate with homosexuals, and I know my compassion is very limited, my compassion compared to God's compassion has got to be very limited. And if I've got the compassion and I see other people who have compassion for people like this, then obviously God has got to have compassion. I mean, does that make sense?
Yes.
Recently, within the last 2 years, we've become acquainted with a couple of people who are homosexuals. And at first, it was very, very difficult to deal with these people. And then all of a sudden, I decided I was going to look at them just as a human being. And if you look at them just as a human being, you become very, very lovely people. I mean, multi-talented. One guy is just multi-talented, you know, and has a concern and a love for other people that a lot of straight people haven't had. And I've learned a lot in just knowing these people about myself and about my relationship to other people, just being able to see them as I am, basically sinful, but still human. Well, our humanness is sinful, but it's really, as I say, it's really difficult to deal with because our training says this is not right, and yet here is a person who we just saw a couple of weeks ago, you know? And here is a guy, I mean, he's about my age, and he really has a deep compassion for people. I mean, he goes out of his way to help people who are in trouble. And so you have to look at him as just really a loving human being and forget about the sexual. I think when you were talking about the conservatives going out and getting after them, I'm just wondering, from what you were saying on this chart, you can't help but wonder if maybe those guys that are the conservative ones are having the most trouble with the problem.
They're certainly the most fearful.
And yeah, certainly are having problems as well. Yeah. Yeah. Personally aware of my situation. He thinks we protest.
I'm not sure most people believe that it's obvious that God created homosexuals. In my parish experience and conversations on the issue, I would suggest that most people believe that they have created themselves homosexual. God had nothing to do with it. Yeah, that's what I think my people believe.
I think that's very true.
I think that some kind of a graph, you know, like that one up there could be made for people's attitudes towards homosexuality. You know, on the one end, there are people who feel that it's just totally, you know, anti-creation, abnormal, sinful, immoral, all the bad things, Jared Swallow. On the other side is the advocacy of the lifestyle, as if, like you said before, that this is only one of several options. And then people who are just a little bit to the side where, sort of like, homosexuals are unacceptable. We need to relate to them as people, as you were just saying. But that I find people that I've talked to feel that it's something that they need to be working on. In other words, they're okay with me. They're okay with me if they are seeking help for this problem, as opposed to accepting them unconditionally. I think that's kind of an attitude that might. I'm just guessing, but that might be prevalent in the church.
Yeah. I think that's true, certainly, in my own experience. When I think back to when I first started to get into this field and started to deal with the sexual orientation issues, probably because my own orientation, like I say, is over here to one or one and a half. It's pretty much toward this end. And one of the overriding questions that popped into my mind, I didn't really like it, but what do they do with each other, you know? And so I got preoccupied with their bedroom. Yet nobody gets preoccupied with my bedroom, really. You know, but I found myself really getting into that sort of thing and having to struggle through that,
that issue. That I think that there's sort of a middle ground where we are sort of willing to accept homosexuality if the homosexual says, yeah, I got a problem that I'm trying to get over.
Yep.
However, if the homosexual is militant in terms of gay liberation or celebrates the lifestyle in any way, now that's a different story. That kind of homosexual who is glad about it, as opposed to the one who says, I'm in a lot of pain, mm-hmm. and I'm struggling with this. There are two different kinds of attitudes that we can come up with. And
yep.
that's kind of what I think where I plug into the issue is, go back and forth myself mm-hmm. between those two extremes. Of
But somehow they ought to be able to change,
somehow,
or at least if they're willing to try.
Yes,
then.
Yes.
But within the church, I look at the church as the whole, and there really aren't too many people within the church who are even willing to admit that they're sinful, much less being a homosexual.
Yeah.
I mean, we're catty, and we talked earlier about talking about other people, and this goes on all the time, and yet we will not admit that we have any problems. We're up here, and these homosexuals are down here. They're the ones that have to admit that they're sinful, not us. And I've spent a lot of time recently, especially during Lent, thinking of how white Christ is and how dirty I really am in comparison. And when I look at myself in that relationship, there is no way that I can look down on somebody who's homosexual or alcoholic or whatever, because I am just as sinful, if not more so, than they are. So therefore, who am I to sit around and say, you are wrong and I am right, because we're all in the same sinking boat, and the only one that can save us is Jesus.
Don't we say that every
Sunday? One question here, or thought here, and then one there.
I have a question, basically, and I'd like to backtrack a little bit for a more specific definition of homosexuality, because is it a point on the spectrum, or on the bell curve? Is it one particular point, or is it a specific sex act? I'm thinking of the letter that you read. The pastor loves his wife, he loves his children, he loves his people in his parish, and basically this is what all Christians do. They love everybody, or they try to love everybody equally. So what makes a homosexual a homosexual? Does he have more dreams of the same sex, or at what point is he?
For you.
Let me try one sort of run at that, and it may not get on what, because what you're asking is real important. But one of the ways I was helped to think about that whole broad idea of sexuality and homosexuality, heterosexuality, and so on, was when somebody asked me, and I'll ask you to do the same thing, try and picture in your mind if you're a male that feels yourself to be opposite sex or heterosexually oriented, or if you're a female that feels that that's pretty much your orientation. Picture in your mind that you're now living in a dormitory with only opposite sex people. If you're a male, you're living only with women. And you're going to shower with them, you're going to bathe, you're going to sleep in the same rooms, dormitory rooms, and so on. And try and be in touch with what you're feeling as far as your sexuality goes. Can you get that picture at all? That's what this particular homosexual told me it was like to live in a culture that was totally opposite sex oriented. Was that he was constantly put with other males and was then asked to not be sexual, not to have sexual feelings, not to have sexual attractions, not to experience. And that's what he was saying. Not that he would act on it, not that he would, but that there was that constant kind of
really have
pressure
no
and stimulation.
Go, really not having an alternative to that, other than to go into a community of his own, get together.
That's the issue that most of my gay and lesbian friends really struggle with. They're most of them are Christian, and they don't, the church is just giving them these awful messages. They don't have anywhere to go. The gay bar scene seems to be the place, and that's not for them, and there's just not a community of friends.
And it is almost the only alternative, because it is so large.
I have a question, and that is, the question is it possible that the teachings of our upbringing were incomplete?
I'm not sure, because I feel like I taught my children the things that I thought had value. How could I teach them that? I don't know that, you know? So how could you say it's incomplete?
I'm asking the question.
No, I'm just saying, in my own mind, answering it, how could I say it was incomplete, you know?
It was complete as well as you could, as you could do.
Even the best I had.
I'd like to heal you.
We're talking about the adult and how we're going to relate to it. My guess is that most of us with children, given the choice, would prefer that our children were not homosexual or lesbian. And so the question also becomes, how do we help the development to be heterosexual? Which I would guess most of us would prefer, for many reasons, and certainly societal reaction.
Pain, save them pain.
Most of us probably picture a good marriage, grandchildren, all the rest. I can't help but feel that part of the problem has become more because of how we as Americans live. I grew up on a farm, 9 kids, 2 bedrooms. I never slept alone until I went to college. I had 2 sisters, but I had 5 brothers, we were 4 girls. There was a lot of physical closeness. I can't help but feel that part of this, every kid has to have their bedroom and go to bed alone. Awful. I'd hate to go to bed alone.
Lack of touch or the disembodiment.
I think sexuality is an ongoing process. I think sometimes it can skip some words. Physical closeness with people of the same sex. And I'm not even talking of overt sexuality, but physical closeness somehow gets missed along the line. And I sometimes think that although there are people, homosexuals, that feel like they were homosexual forever, I think it's also possible that some of them became that way because the sexual development never really completed. And maybe they were minus a father, maybe there was a one parent, maybe there just wasn't a good, wholesome sexuality within the home. I think it's tough for one parent.
I'd like to come back to that, but let me...
I wanted to speak to that same thing. Sure. I used to teach sex education. I was a PE major, and so it cost probably 15 years ago, and I don't know how this has changed because I've been away from it for that long, but 15 years ago it was considered that a certain part of sexual development around between age 10 and 12, the most common relationship with other people was same sex. And I don't know if that's theoretically changed or not, and maybe sleeping in separate bedrooms, which is more common now than it used to be, has anything to do with it. But I think that is part of sexual development, that if it's skipped, it may have some influence on that. But that's back when I was learning about homosexuality 15 years ago, and there's a lot more research done on it now. So.
Yeah, and the more the research that's done on it is... if you could ever figure out what makes a homosexual, you've only done half the job, because then you'd have to figure out what makes a heterosexual.
I also
no one really knows.
Where the kids can come climbing into bed with the parents. And our problem was we never had a king size.
I know from my own personal experience that homosexuality isn't caught.
It's not catching.
My father died when I was 4, and the uncle who became the father surrogate for me, while he had a marriage of convenience to my aunt, was homosexual. And he taught me to hunt and to fish, and I know one of the things that he was very honest and open, but he totally, totally respected my boundaries as to who there was no, and that's one of the myths around homosexuals, is that they're going to be pedophiliacs and so on and so forth. But I deeply loved that man and learned a lot from him. But I know I didn't catch homosexuality from him. So I know for a fact that's not how. And in talking with people who are gay, there's, you know, they really can't identify where it comes from. So there seems to be the group that can never identify that they ever had any other feelings, like this pastor, who, as he reflects and looks back on his life, sees himself as different, growing up differently, having different kinds of feelings and thoughts. Probably, if he went further, would say, as some of the people that I know, that when they first went to movies or watched television, they would, instead of falling in love with some female actress, or if it was a female, some male actor, would fall in love with somebody of the same sex. You know, they can't identify any, almost a constitutional kind of thing that would show up. There are others that become aware of it more, like you say, at the age of puberty or shortly after, and they start to struggle with that. Some experiment with it and then go back. So it's hard to, I just know that it's not caught, and no one seems to know exactly where it does come from.
In the pastor's letter, I think he laid out beautifully the dilemma that he was facing, and I think we've talked a little bit about that kind of problem. You say, what's the message to your friends, or how does the gospel then speak a word? Wonder if we could take some time.
Yeah, I would like to do that. I'd like to try and, for about 3 minutes, just get us into that by suggesting some things that comes from a friend of mine who's written, I think, one of the better books on the whole thing, the book Embodiment. His name is Dr. James Nelson. And if you haven't read that and have an interest in exploring this further, I think Jim begins to open some doors for thinking about it. You may not necessarily, he's a theological ethics professor at United Theological Seminary in St. Paul. You may not necessarily agree with his theology, and that's fine. But I think that it does open some doors to beginning to reflect on it from that perspective of the moral, ethical issues. Because there's a way in which it would be easy to whitewash Scripture, too, you know, to swing to that other extreme. And there are passages in Scripture that I think we need to look at, real hard ones, around the whole thing of homosexuality. And it's not enough to just whitewash it and say, God didn't intend, or the Scriptures didn't intend to condemn. You know, like the pastor again says, he has no trouble saying that it's an abnormal thing, but he doesn't see it as something that then we have to say they're bad people and they're condemned to hell and project the whole thing. Okay, the couple of things that I'd like to just real quickly suggest. One of it comes with the history of how we've dealt with embodiment in the church generally. That there's been traditionally three basic positions toward embodiment, none of which speak to incarnation or reconciliation. One would be the tradition that medievalists would take, that would say that control by reason and will of one's sexual feelings and thoughts and ways of being, you can control it. Like someone suggested, well, you can change if you want to and you're acceptable if you're trying to, would be a medievalist position. The other extreme of that would be one that would be identified as the Dionysian position. I'm talking about sexuality, probably shouldn't use the word position. it's an attitude that's probably the oldest, and yet it's perennially new. And it's one in which sexuality is seen as that which has been artificially repressed. Hence, to throw off all the social mass, this group would say, to rediscover your inner forces and feelings, and at the same time be reunited with a cosmic vitality. the interesting thing was if you push this school far enough, the sexual communication never becomes personal. The sexual is always somehow separate. It never has to do with me and you and what we have on a much broader level. It's always an impersonal kind of sexuality. And the third one is that more typified by and written about by a person by the name of Tom Driver at Union Seminary, where he's tried to demythologize the whole sexual thing. But in the process, it ends up that sex really, really doesn't count, doesn't matter. One way or the other is as good as the next, and you end up having to kind of whitewash a lot of the stuff. My belief is, in reading Jim Nelson and some of my own thinking, is that we better get on with the business of reconciliation, that the degree to which I reject my own embodiment is in a typical male stereotyped way. And because the male image is the one that has historically dealt with the interpretation of scriptures and the theologizing, males are much more disembodied than females historically. But we've laid it on females, so you have a whole community of females that have also disowned their own bodies. But that kind of degree to which we've done that is the degree to which we can't deal honestly and openly with reconciliation and homosexuality. You had a question or thought?
I'm not sure what you're saying when you say that males are more disembodied. I don't know what that means.
Okay. One of the... St. Augustine, for example, probably said it most crassly when he said, my penis has a will of its own. It's as though one is led around by one's sexuality and you have to, it's not a part of me. It's or by the statement that is often made, I have a body, not I am a body. It's as though it's the same thing as in the theologian, the old heresy of docetism, that salvation comes when I will escape this body. And Christ, if he's spoken anything, both in his birth and his life and his death and resurrection, it has been the theme of incarnation, that we are literally saved in the body. It's not resurrection even of the body, it's resurrection in the body.
Are you aware of the statement by the Minnesota Synod on homosexuality?
Yes.
What was the thrust of that the minority group argued so strongly against?
Well, it's the point that was being made earlier here, I think you were making, that it's okay to be, so long as you're trying to change, and the ALC statement comes out basically saying, well, you know, it's okay to be homosexual, just don't practice it. As long as you can't help who you are, but just don't do it, you know, which is a real...
James, would you handle one thing for me? I mean, scripturally, how do you address this? This is what I have trouble dealing with. I realize that scripturally there's so many things that really tell me where I'm at, mm-hmm. and I'm not very happy with that. I mean, I'd like to do something about changing it. But I think I could understand it better if I had somebody address that particular part for me.
Okay. The first thing, I think, is that the condemnation of homosexuality, especially in the Old Testament, seemed to be more of the exploitation that goes along with that. If you take the passages out of Exodus and so on. In other words, or the Sodom and Gomorrah story. That the condemnation was of the exploitation. And Scripture consistently is clear. Christ is clear on that. In the Gospels,
the New Testament is clear that exploitation, in other words, a violation of someone else's boundaries, and there is a way in which the homosexual community has been always needing to, somebody mentioned it, the place we force homosexuals today is to the gay bars, it's to cruising, it's to the baths, it's to not forming close and good relationships. And so lots of times there is that kind of exploitation. Scripture is real clear on that. Scripture is clear on the fact that one of the intents of being created sexual is for reproduction, and of course that is not possible for the homosexual. It's real clear on that. So there is that sense of alienation from the body as far as reproduction goes. I don't want to get too far into that because we're just starting to emerge, coming out of the fact of realizing that the other part of the creation story is for the enjoyment of our sexuality. But there is that piece of it that we need to take seriously. Let me say one more thing, Dick. And then, of course, one has to look at Paul and Pauline statements regarding homosexuality, and he equates it along with a variety of perversions. And I think one way of looking at that is, again, around the exploitation theme. That he was speaking very, very clearly to a particular situation within his Greek tradition of where not only homosexuals are being exploited, but all kinds of people were guilty of all kinds of perversions and exploitation in the Greek community. So I think, you know, we need to look at some of those, strongly keeping in mind that, like someone over here mentioned, that all of us fall short of we're all to some degree alienated, and that alienation is in the body, and to project it out on one group without dealing also with ourselves is not going to solve the problem. It's not going to bring us to a point of reconciliation.
When I was in college, I had a very good friend who was a gifted musician, and I used to do a lot of talking and things, and I went out and taught for a year, and when I came back for my last year of college, I discovered that he had left and he had gone into a homosexual relationship in Old Town Chicago. And at that time, it was quite devastating. I really didn't understand it, so I went and I wanted to see him and talk to him. And he said it was the tremendous loneliness he felt. He talked to me, but I didn't want to be his girlfriend or anything. He said it was a relationship, fine. And he said, I was so lonely, and I needed someone to touch, and to touch me. And that was part of it. And it was funny that I understood that. I could understand that, and I could accept it on that basis. And I couldn't question him or condemn him on it, because that, how can you, we've all felt that need for touching and that extreme loneliness of being alone.
And if that, you see, that's the point I think we're being, if we could really take seriously the fact that we are embodied, that we do have boundaries, and that there are appropriate ways to touch within families, within congregations, and so on, then I think we could begin to pull away from looking at that and looking at what is the alienation that the gay person might have, what is my alienation from my body, from my orientation, and begin to then really start to look at how is reconciliation happen around that.
I was just going to comment that perhaps though a person who is trying very hard, such as the pastor in the letter, to relate in a straight way to people, maybe has lots of people with whom to touch and be in contact, and is still lonely because of this sense of himself that, you know, it isn't just a lack merely of somebody to touch and to care. And that's the hardest phenomenon to get at, to understand, to try to identify with, I think. For me it is, anyway. To imagine how a person who is surrounded with loving people and who says that he's in a loving relationship can still feel that isolation. I mean, I believe it. I very much believe it. It's very difficult, though, to identify them. I think we need to work on that somehow. I don't know.
You know, as homosexuals come out of the closet, and it's a progression, and it's going to happen more and more, we are going to find that we have found the enemy, and they are us.
Yeah.